Welcome, all of you wine and true crime lovers. I'm Brandy.
And I'm Chris.
And this is Texas Wine and True Crime. Thank you for being here tonight, friends, for this week's episode, A Fatal Exam, Solving Lubbock's Greatest Murder Mystery. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Brandy.
We have an awesome guest tonight.
We do.
That I'm about to introduce. But before I do that, we will be at Henry's Majestic again, first Thursday of May. So
every month.
Every month, but now we're going into May.
Yes.
We've already done April. So come see us. We get, I mean, it's full.
Yeah, every, we had a great crowd.
Great crowd.
We were outside on the stage, so it was nice.
And we'll be on the stage in May.
Yes.
So come see us. Again, if you're local right here in Dallas, Henry's Majestic, first Thursday of every month. This week, or actually this entire month, we are going to be doing Horseshoe Bend Cellars Vineyard and Winery right out of Iowa Park, Texas. So we're going to be talking about the food here in just a second.
Okay.
Actually, right now, go ahead. Tell us, what did we have this week?
Well, we had a Riesling.
Yes, we did.
And it was a very dry, not too sweet Riesling. And so I decided to...
They stuck with the German roots on the Riesling, which I appreciate.
Yes, it was a very good wine. And I decided to pair that with some Asian food. So I made chicken satay and egg rolls, some little spring rolls, and then some dumplings as well to go along. So, but it went really nice. Very good... very good drinking wine. It's, you know, starting to get a little warm outside. So
yes, it is
good for sitting by the pool.
We're getting into the white season.
Yes,
the white wine season. Yes, it was very good as always.
Thank you.
And then later on this week, we are going to put out episode number two. We're going to do two episodes this week. Just because of the way you paired both of these dishes, we're not going to talk about the second dish just yet. But we, so be listening for that coming up. I do believe we are going to be putting that out on Sunday. So be listening for that. But let me tell you a little bit about Horseshoe Bend, because I think... First of all, we've been there. We got to go and record there.
It's very close.
Very close.
Very accessible.
Very accessible. They do a murder mystery dinners, and I'm kind of fascinated with it. I'm reading. So I've never done a murder mystery. I know that might surprise a lot of people. I have never been to a murder mystery dinner. Neither have you. We need to do this. And so this might be our first
Clue before.
Yes, I've played Clue, and I'm very good at Clue. All right, so, but Chris, this is why, so they have murder mystery events, and before you arrive at the event, you get an invitation with instructions, and I could be, like, totally fascinated by this, and this could be, like, for all of them, but I just don't know, because I've never been to one. But you receive an invitation with instructions and a unique character card, and then all of the characters in the game are listed, you know, like listed there, so then you can become acquainted with your like fellow suspects. I love that.
And kinda,
then
they kind of like Clue.
Kind of like Clue. And they're all dressed up in like these really great outfits, and they do like speakeasy character list, wedding characters, saloon characters. I mean, it's awesome. It's awesome. So let's go see our friends at Horseshoe Bend Cellars. Again, they are in Iowa Park, which if you're not familiar with that, it's just right outside of Wichita Falls. So not far. So Wichita Falls listeners, I'm sure you're already drinking some great wine over at Horseshoe Bend. But if you're not, get there. In Dallas, DFW folks, quick shot down there to visit them. So thank you, Horseshoe Bend, for graciously having us at your winery, but then sending us home with some great wine to talk about for this month. So excited about that. All right, Chris. It's time to introduce our guests. Excited about this. Again, this is Fatal Exam, Solving Lubbock's Greatest Murder Mystery. We are interviewing author Alan Burton tonight. His co-author, Chuck Lanhart, could not be here with us this evening, but great book, friends. Pick this book up. Let me tell you a little bit about Alan. Throughout his professional writing career, Alan Burton has been honored by the Associated Press, Texas School Public Relations Association, and Oklahoma College Public Relations Association. His resume includes 40 years of experience in media communications field. Chris, he is a 1979 graduate of Texas Tech University. He wrote this book, which is his first true crime book. Which is exciting. And he has been nominated for recognition in the Writers League of Texas Book Awards in the category of nonfiction. Now, other books that he's written include topics of Texas sports, music, radio, and history. Now, his one book, Squib, Kick It to a Fat Guy, and 699 more memorable quotes from the playbook of Coach Mike Leach. Chris, this was a bestseller in two Amazon categories. It, just in 2022, December 2022, this book has recorded sales in 40 states, four countries. This guy's doing it right. Welcome, Alan. Thank you so much for being here this evening.
Thank you for having me on.
So as I mentioned just a few seconds ago, we are going to be talking about the book you and author Chuck Lainhart put out together. And this is called Fatal Exam. We're talking about Lubbock's greatest murder mystery, like you have on the title and the cover of your book. And we're going back to December 4th of 1967 at Texas Tech. But before we dive in, tell us, me, I'd love to know why this book, why this case? This is something I ask all my authors, you know, why this one?
I think a couple of things. Number one, I was just amazed that no one had ever written a book on this before, because it's a really fascinating case. And once I got into the research, it was just, I mean, it was just twists and turns like you wouldn't believe. I just kept finding different things that were just unbelievable. So that intrigued me. And I guess the other reason is I remember I was probably, 10 years old when the crime actually happened. So I vaguely remember, because it was pretty big news across the state. And so I was aware of the crime when it happened. And then later on, I went to Texas Tech, and probably 10 years after the crime. So it wasn't really talked about very much 10 years afterwards, but over the years I'd heard it discussed. I have family that still lives in Lubbock, and every now and then, you know, it would come up when we talk about it. And then lo and behold, I don't know, about 20 years ago, I sat down and thought, I want to write a book on that. And here we are 20 years later.
Wow. Very cool. Wow. So this has been a project for a while.
I started in 2004, believe it or not. Very first thing I did was, go to Lubbock and able to get into the archives of the Lubbock Avalanche Journal. They were very, very gracious, and just started going through all the old newspaper articles. That's how it started. And like I say, it was a 20-year project, off and on, off and on. And just, you know, after 20 years, I was just really glad to get it out.
Well, it was published, I believe, last year, right? 2023, the book came out.
Right.
And
right.
This is, I loved the book, by the way. Very well done to you. Props to you and Chuck for, I love one that people go back and get in the archives. I use newspapers.com for a ton of my research. And the thing I love about the archived newspaper articles the most is you really get a sense of like what was happening in the moment, right? The people's perceptions.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally. It's amazing. Back in that era, this would have been in the 60s when I did the research, and it was amazing how thorough a job the newspapers did on coverage. I mean, it was unbelievable. They didn't miss anything. They covered everything.
Love it. Yeah. And I mean, it's just fascinating sometimes, especially when you go back, right, in the 50s, the 60s, and we look at some of the things happening in that moment. So we are talking about Sarah Alice Morgan. She was a Texas Tech custodian working in the science building that evening. So this was in the evening. There are other custodians working in the building. And this is on the third floor. Now, on the second floor, happening at the same time that this murder takes place, there's classes going on. So there are people in and out of this building. Sarah Morgan was a, she was found in the, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm pulling my notes from what I read. But so she's found in an office of a professor. Is that right?
It's more of a lab, I guess you would say, more than the office.
Okay, so she's found in the lab. But there was a professor that had his materials and things in that office. So can you kind of give us tell us kind of what the scene was like in regard to what room this is, why, who would have access to this room, and anything else you can tell us.
Sure. As you said, this was on a Monday night, and building was crowded. They had night classes, as you said, on the second floor. And the third floor was basically faculty offices and labs. And this particular lab, the professor was actually down on the second floor at that time teaching a class that evening. And so the custodian, she was just going about her rounds cleaning the rooms, and just happened up to that third floor lab, and walked in, and without going to all the details, walked in on someone who was in there who was not supposed to be in there. That floor was basically off limits to students. It was basically professors, graduate assistants. So students were not supposed to be up there. And so that's what happened. She walked in on someone who was not supposed to be in that lab.
Was it like, was there a medical school, I guess, on, I mean, because it was what they found, some of the items that they used to perform the murder.
That's, yeah, was it really? This was like a biology lab.
Okay.
So they had, you know, it was a very horrific crime. There was a scalpel that was used in the murder, which was sitting there in the lab, and a saw. I mean, it was just very, very horrific crime.
So we said this happened on December the 4th. So this is Christmas time, right? Christmas season, school is in. But Lubbock does this Christmas lights thing. By the way, do they still do this?
They do. I actually went to the one just last December.
Okay.
And it's like, it's a huge event. I mean, it is, they had 20,000 people there.
Wow.
It's a huge event now. More so than it was back in 1967.
But this murder took place the day before this event. Is that right?
Right. The night before. And it just so happens the Carol of the Lights events is held outside right in front of the science building where the crime occurred. So you had all these people, 15,000 people probably back then, right, camped out in front of the science building where the night before this horrible murder had happened.
So do you, I was reading this part and I had to stop and think, was there any discussion of canceling this event? Did they think that there was something for the public to worry about? I'm trying to get a sense of like what people were thinking and feeling. Were they not giving much information by this point to the public? What were your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I've never, in all the research, that's a very good question. In fact, I thought the same thing, but I never saw any reference to canceling the event at all. I do know that, as you might expect, you know, there was fear just among the campus. Sure. I mean, it just freaked everybody out. And so I know in particular the female students, you know, were just terrified, and they had, you know, male students and campus police, you know, walk with them to their cars at night, and they had all the dorms locked, and they had campus police who were guarding the dorms and that kind of thing. So I think it was just, you know, such a horrific crime, the unknown, not knowing what exactly happened.
So do you want to talk about the suspect? Should we give his name and discuss that?
Yeah, again, that's sort of what makes the case sort of interesting. The suspect was named Benjamin Locke, and he was a student enrolled at Texas Tech at the time. He was actually a pre-med student, had aspirations of being a doctor, by all indications, a very intelligent individual. And apparently he was up on the third floor. Again, he was not supposed to be up there. Supposedly he was looking around. He was going to steal some exams for a test. And the custodian walked in on him, I guess just sort of surprised him. He just sort of just, you know, reacted and knocked her out, and then just sort of killed her right there in the lab. And then just sort of calmly walked out, walked across the street and studied in the library for a little while.
I want to leave some suspense for the readers, right? I want them to get this book because I couldn't put it down. I mean, it's great. And I had never heard of this case. And by the way, there are so many other cases you mention in this book that I was not familiar with. And so I'm looking forward to just diving more into those, you know, some out of Baylor, some things that were happening in different parts of Texas at the time. There was also another, I believe, custodian that had been killed in the Boston area, right, where this gentleman was from. And I know that they had tried to come down and question him. Did they ever, was he ever questioned about that crime? Did they eventually get into questioning him about other things?
I don't believe so. Again, the research that I did, there was not a lot of firm information on that.
Yeah.
So I never was able to quite uncover, you know, the story behind all that.
Yeah. So, Chris, a little bit about that. That kind of was fascinating to me. They came, they wanted to come to Texas and talk to this guy because it was very similar in what happened in Sarah's case. But they weren't allowed to talk to him at the time, probably because there was still an ongoing investigation here, mm-hmm. right? And they wanted to make sure that, you know, Texas was focusing on their investigation. But there was talk of possibly him being involved in a similar crime up where his family was living and where he was from. So, all right. So Benjamin Locke is his name. Now, can you talk a little bit about this guy? Because when I was reading about him and looking at my newspapers, you have a lot of people saying that was very surprised it could have been him. And then you had other people saying, yeah, he's a little quirky, a little strange, came off a little, you know, what were your thoughts about this gentleman?
Yeah, it was sort of a mixed bag. I mean, outwardly, he seemed to be very intelligent, was well-liked. And so I think it was just a shock to everyone. And who knows? You know, you mentioned there were some other murders along that during that time period, and some of them were very similar. And who knows? And to this individual's credit, you know, he served some prison time. But in prison, earned 3 college degrees and was just, as they say, a model prisoner or model inmate, and was released. And from all indications, has gone on and lived a very normal life and has turned his life around, been totally rehabilitated. So to me, that's another intriguing part of the story that you know, a person for whatever reason did such a horrific thing. But at the same time, they were able to, in effect, turn their life around.
Alan, I can't tell you how many cases we have covered, and that's exactly what happens. I mean, it's very, you know, I we have police officers, friends who go, stop trying to get into their minds. Like, you know, you're trying to think of like a psychopath, right? Or have these, you know, psychopath tendencies. And it's hard to wrap our heads around something that they do that's so horrific, because her murder was horrific. I mean, she was almost completely decapitated. And just the brutality of this. And
well, especially just for getting caught, like, you know.
I thought about that too.
That's very strange.
Why not run out?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's because he was so,
I guess, as a graduate student too, and you know, cheating is such a big deal and getting kicked out. I mean, that's the only
thing. Well, and the pressures of family, right? To do well in school.
Yeah, but it's one of those things you can't explain it. I mean, there is no explanation. I mean, I'm just, like I say, I read all the articles and all the psychiatrists, and I don't think anyone can explain why.
Yeah, because it's not like a targeted attack or anything, you know. I mean, so
no.
Unless, I guess, was there any way he knew she had like the keys and stuff like that?
I don't think so. I think it was just random. I think she just was cleaning that room and walked in wrong place at the wrong time.
I find it, and then I also, in the book, there are 2 students that, okay, I want to talk about 2 things. One, there was a professor that was teaching at the time. His name is brought up in your book quite often, of people seeing him. Possibly there was a bloody shirt that was found in one of the trash bins within the science building. And this professor's name comes up a lot, especially in the trial. So did they ever focus on this professor? Did they ever think he had anything to do with this?
No, I don't think so. I think that was more or less, that was probably a defense attorney tactic to try to deflect. I don't think there was ever any credible information. Again, there were just so many twists and turns and ironic things that happened in this story. It was just, you know, just hard to believe.
And then you had 2, I believe, students that went up to that science lab and tried to get in or knocked on it. Can you clarify that a little bit?
Yeah, they were both graduate assistants at, in this professor who was teaching. It was his lab. He had asked them. They were down. Their office was next door to his classroom on the second floor. And the professor asked the two students, grads, to go up to his lab and mix some chemicals for something for the next day. So they just innocently walked upstairs to the third floor to do that. And the door was locked. And they looked around and checked the, and all the doors were locked. So I just figured, well, I guess the custodians are on break or something. So we'll come back later. And the ironic thing is one of those two graduate assistants ended up being the president of Texas Tech years later, David Smidley. So again, you know, how ironic is that?
Wow. Crazy. Well, and she was already deceased at this time. And they just didn't see her. Is that what they?
Well, the door is locked, so they never actually went through the room.
Oh, that's right. There was no windows on this door, room.
There were no windows. They theorized that they went up there right when it was probably happening.
Ugh.
And this building still stands.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they still do. They still do the lights in front of this building. Same
yes,
place.
They do.
Wow.
The same place, yeah.
Wow. All right. So there are anything you want to talk about with the trial? There was now I read about he was sent away into Rusk, Texas, for a while. And were they trying to get him? Chris, they basically said he wasn't competent to stand trial at the time, so they sent him away to a facility in Rust, Texas, and then he ended up standing in
a psychiatric facility.
Yes, yep. And then he ended up going to trial. Were they trying to rehabilitate him? What were they trying to accomplish in sending him away?
You know, in the research I did back then, that was a fairly common thing to do. They actually, a lot of times they would, especially on a crime that was just so horrific and didn't make any sense, a lot of times they must have heard, well, that person wasn't sane or wasn't competent to know what he was doing to stand trial. So it wasn't uncommon back then to send them to the state hospital. And I think they did get some treatment. And then in this case, they sent him back to Lubbock back after a year and certified him as sane and ready to stand trial. So who knows, you know,
that's what kind of blows my mind.
He was a college student too. I mean, who knows? Maybe they were
given,
I mean, not send him straight away to prison. Who knows?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. You're insane, but can't stand trial. But a year later, you're rehabilitated and can stand trial. I don't know. I'm just curious.
Well, I'm sure his attorneys probably pushed that a little bit too, you know, so.
Right.
Yeah. All right. And then I hear that there are some ghost stories and things that stick around with, you know, people saying that they see blood sometimes on the floor of that lab. Is all of that structure still the same? I know Chris said the building is still standing, but did they change any of the interior or is everything the same?
Over the years, they've done some renovations, remodeling, some additions. So, the basic structure is the same, but it has changed a little bit.
So what are some of the ghost stories? Because you went to Tech. So what did you hear over the years?
You know, like I said, I was out there about 10 years after it happened, and it really wasn't discussed. I guess just enough time had passed by, so it wasn't really, you know, a topic of discussion, you know, at that point in time.
I don't think I'd want to go to that lab, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, actually, at the time of the crime, it was the science building. Now I think it's the physics geosciences building is the term.
Okay.
But the actual structure still is there.
Okay, so you said that there are so many twists and turns, and I want our listeners to get this book. Again, Fatal Exam, we will tell you where you can find it. Great book, couldn't put it down. But can you just give us a couple of twists or turns that that really stood out to you?
Yeah, there are a couple that come to mind. They actually, the police actually talked to what you call a psychic or a person who did ESP to just try to get help. And so, I mean, they were looking to try anything and didn't really factor into the case, but at least they did talk to someone. And I guess to me, probably the strangest thing, this was to me straight out of the movies, how they caught the individual. They actually had a stakeout in a different professor's room. He thought that, someone had been coming in stealing his test, and he had this one particular individual in mind that his grades were improved. So he thought, well, maybe it could be him. So this particular week, he planned a big test. And so he called the police. They actually had two detectives that spent the night in the professor's office. And that's how they actually caught him. He walked in there and had the key that he had stolen and tried to get in. And well, the crazy thing is he saw the detectives and ran off and got away. He ran right out the building and got away from them and then stole a car and was speeding through Lubbock. And I guess the call went out there was a stolen car. They didn't know it was this guy. They just thought it was a stolen car. So the police chased him all through Lubbock and he ends up crashing to a cemetery. And that's when they catch him.
Wow. Hey, you wonder if he was like stealing other tests and things like that leading up. I mean, this is months after.
So. I don't know. Yeah.
By dumb luck, he got caught.
Yeah, it really was. On the day they decide to do this, you know, or the few days for the stakeout. Yeah, that's interesting. So you you mentioned he only served a little time. So 15 years of his 40-year sentence. He did go to trial, got 40 years, spent 15, like you said, a model citizen. And is he up back up north? Did he stay in Texas?
No, I think he moved. He was from the New England area. So I believe he's back up in that area. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else that really kind of stood out to you that you want our listeners to know? There's so much I want to talk to you about, but I don't want to give it all away. But anything else you want to share with us, or why should people read this? What is the fascination behind this to you, and why do people need to read it?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. Number one, as I said earlier, I don't think the stories had ever been fully told. And that's what I was amazed that no one had ever written a book on it, because like I say, it was just a fascinating case to me. Then I guess the other thing that stands out, it makes maybe a little more intriguing, is I was able to actually interview some of the people who were there when it happened. I was able to interview the two prosecuting attorneys who have now passed away since that time. But like I said, I started it 20 years ago. So I was fortunate enough to talk to some of the people. I talked to a couple of the detectives and some of the people. So I got a little sense. In other words, it wasn't just old news archives. I got a sense of perspective from talking to some of the people who were actually part of the case. And so I think that adds a little bit to the book.
Now, we've covered some other cases in Lubbock, and I know we have lots of Lubbock listeners, so I would, friends, reach out and let us know if you've heard about this case, because I had shared with you, Alan, I was not familiar with this case, and I have just a mild fascination in West Texas true crime history. I've covered some cases that people that came through Texas that something happened, and people from Texas back between the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and so forth. But when you're talking to them and interviewing them, did you get a sense that this is something that, you know, sort of plagued Texas Tech University? Were people afraid of, you know, breaking into tests? Was there higher security? Were police on more high alert? Were women walking around? What was your sense of that talking to them in those interviews?
Yeah, I think there was for maybe a short period. I don't think it was a long lasting effect. I think for the short term, sure, there was a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety on campus. But I think, you know, after a while, things got back to normal. I don't think it was a long time cloud that hung over the university or the city. It was just, you know, it was a shocking crime for the time, and especially in West Texas. I mean, that kind of thing just didn't happen.
Well, and they caught the guy, too. So, I mean, I think that eased everybody's angst.
And we might mention there was like a 3-month interval between the actual crime and when he was apprehended. So there was 3 months there where it was pretty full of anxiety.
Well, that's why I was wondering, for those 3 months, if he had that key, was he kind of, you know, doing things with it? And you know, once he realized he had it, so I mean, clearly he was in that lab and maybe looking for, you know, to cheat at that moment. So it's kind of, you never really know.
That's true. There's a lot still unknown.
Alan, where can people find Fatal Exam?
Basically online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any basically online outlet, it should be available.
Perfect. And you have another author who wrote this with you, Chuck Lanehart, but he could not be here. So please give him our thanks. Please tell him that you both wrote an excellent book. This is 20 years of research and sweat, blood, tears, I'm sure. So friends, go and get this book. Let's support these authors that we have on our show. And you get to learn all about different Texas crime. Alan, I'm sure you are familiar with Skip Hollandsworth, but he's sort of local editorial hero. And I like sending him things and books that that come across and say, have you heard of this? So I will be sending him a picture of this, and I want to know what his thoughts are. And because I have not seen a Texas Monthly article on this. Have you?
No, I haven't. I think we'd make an excellent subject, though.
I think so, too. And he's always asking for ideas. So I'm going to be throwing the Skip's way. But Alan, thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yes, thank you.
Friends, go get the book, Fatal Exam, Solving Lubbock's Greatest Murder Mystery. Alan Burton and Chuck Lanhart. Again, Alan, thank you for your time. And always, you're always welcome here at Texas Wine and True Crime. So thank you again.
Thank you so much.